Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
My thing was, I love the gym, you know, and I love training, but I also have this thing which not a lot of people know about, right? Which is the ocean and being a captain and working on the water. And, you know, it's kind of a career that is interesting to a lot of people. You know, I think a lot of the times things get romanticized, you know, when they're around the ocean, but then they don't actually realize that there's a lot of hardworking men and women that are on the water day in and day out, you know, building brands, companies, organizations that kind of revolve around the ocean, you know, and the outdoors. So when I thought about it, I'm like, well, you know, where can I kind of give my two cents? You know, how can I provide a platform for people? And it's funny, I was at a friend's wedding, and I actually just talked to her last night, and she got married in Fayetteville, North Carolina, because her husband is a Green Beret. And basically in this hotel, I sat down on my laptop and I'm like, I'm going to start a podcast. So I started like recording my voice onto GarageBand, and I was like, my voice sounds terrible. I can't do this. So then I just put it away, you know, and then a year later, I had moved to Hawaii. I was, you know, a captain out there, and it always kind of been marinating in my head as to this is kind of what I wanted to do. And I always got interested in media and in just sharing stories with people, whether it's video, podcasts, blogs, whatever. So, you know, long story short, I created three episodes of what was called Beyond the Buoy, you know, at the time. And then that's a whole nother side story that we don't need to get into. But I created these three episodes just thinking, let's just throw it out there, see what happens. And they were friends of mine. You know, I think two of them I had just met, and then one of them was an oyster farmer here in Narragansett Bay who I've known forever. And, you know, the first few days, I think I got like 25 downloads, and then it kind of spun off from there. And I was like, all right, well, I'll make another one, see what happens. And then that one got like 100 downloads, and I'm like, oh, this is kind of interesting. So I kind of went with it, you know. And when COVID hit, I had like four or five episodes, and that was kind of it. You know, I didn't really have any intentions to build it as to where it is now. But when COVID came and I left and I was kind of at home looking for jobs and whatnot here in Rhode Island, I was like, well, I got nothing else to do. You know, I can train. I can't go to Providence Barbell because it's closed, right? And all the other gyms are. So I can train in my garage, which saves me a bunch of time traveling. Mm-hmm. So why don't I really go at this thing and see where it goes. I'm Zach Rollins with the Alarm Kill Podcast, and this is the Tom Rowland Podcast.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the podcast today. On the Waypoint Outdoor Collective, we've brought together a group of like-minded individuals and like voices so that you can experience all of these great podcasts in one place, and that's the Waypoint Outdoor Collective. I've gotten to know a lot of people that are on the collective. We've had Jeff Maggio on the podcast a couple of times. We've done something with Hunter from Captain's Collective, from Farm Traveler. We've done a bunch of different podcasts with podcasters that are on the Waypoint Outdoor Collective, and we're going to continue to do that. And today, I'm going to bring you one of those podcasters. He's got a podcast called Along the Keel. His name is Zach Rollins, and Along the Keel is a podcast where he goes and he really gets the backstory on a lot of the brands that you know, like, and trust, and see how those brands were built and what's the backstory behind that. It's some pretty interesting stories, and I really like that podcast. So when I thought about having him on, of course, I do my research. I looked up the podcast. I listened to some episodes and followed him on Instagram. Then I also looked for his own personal Instagram, and what I found there made me really want to have him on, because Zach is a very accomplished weightlifter as well, and we get to talk training, which he doesn't talk about on his podcast, but we talked about Olympic weightlifting, powerlifting, strongman events, and just what he's doing and where he plans to go with that and how that fits into his podcast, Along the Keel. So go check out Along the Keel on Instagram, and you can see what his podcast is all about. And I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation with Zach Rollins from Along the Keel. All right, yeah. Zach, man, what's going on?
Not much. Staying busy, you know, working, podcasting, doing the whole thing, and training. Got an upcoming competition. Let's see, I fly out to Utah on next Friday, so that'll be kind of cool. And then, yeah, just staying busy. It's a little cold up here, so not too much time on the water, but, you know, spring's coming. So
where exactly are you?
I am in Rhode Island, in Wickford, Rhode Island. So if anyone's familiar with Rhode Island, it's just east of, just west of Newport, which is arguably the sailing capital of the United States.
Yeah, yeah. And so that... is that how you got into kind of the water, and was it around sailing, or was it around, you know, power boats, or what? How did you get into, you know, the water? Because everything that I watch on your podcast, you know, you're telling these cool stories of you know, behind a brand or what the story is, but mm-hmm. It all kind of relates back to boating in some sort of way. So you seem to have a good history there. How did that happen? How did you get into that?
Yeah, you know, my family has always been into the water, right? Growing up, you know, I've been fortunate to grow up on Wickford Harbor, and you know, moved around. I was born in Laguna Beach, California, and then, which is right on the water as well, and then we lived in Florida, right outside of St. Augustine, for a little while. So the ocean has always kind of been, you know, a pretty big theme in my life, and very thankful for that, because I wouldn't want it any other way. But yeah, boating growing up, you know, I started out with a little rowboat, and then kind of graduated to a little 9.9, you know, Zodiac dinghy. And, you know, throughout the years kind of went up and up, and decided one day that I was going to start working on the water. And I was working on the water since I was about 12, I would say.
Really? How do you start working on the water when you're 12?
Well, you know, here in Rhode Island, it's you know, it's kind of part of the culture. You know, if you live by the coast, it's pretty easy to find a job. So I got a job working for a towboat company, and I was just washing boats. It was the local company, not a very big brand, and washing boats, kind of maintaining, learning a little bit. And then from there, I managed a marina in high school and just kind of worked on that. And that was awesome. You know, met a ton of great people from all around the world. I met people that was their final stop from sailing around the world. So wow. Always kind of picking people's brains and learning from them. And, you know, a lot of people that own boats are pretty well off. Yeah. Right. I mean, there's a certain, you know, there's a certain entry cost when you want to get into a big boat, especially if it's a yacht. So I was always someone that kind of wanted to ask questions and pick their brain. And, I guess that's kind of why I started the podcast in some regard. But yeah, going back, you know, I just kind of graduated and I decided, you know, I was going to work in a boatyard. And from there, I got sick and tired of sanding and painting boats, and I was going to get my captain's license. And that's what I did. So
how old were you?
Yeah, that was kind of my,
right when you got
my license. No. So I got my ticket when I was 20. Okay. So at 20 years old, I got my license. And then I always say it was the quickest, from not being a captain to being a captain, because the guy that offered that was offering the course, he actually hired me right on the spot. He's like, "What are you doing this summer?" I go, "I don't know. I was going to go run a boat." And he's like, "Well, you come work for me." So that's what I did. And I started a recreational boating program teaching people how to drive boats, you know, whether it's docking or you know, anchoring, whatever it is, right? Boating safety. And then also did some captain's course, like learning the back end of that, which was really cool. And, you know, getting to learn all the Coast Guard lingo and kind of the commercial side of what it takes to be a captain. And then, you know, I graduated college and I was like, screw it. I'm going to Hawaii.
Nice.
And that's what I did. I moved to Hawaii and I started working on boats out there. You know, with my license, I was like, I know I'm going to be able to get a job. It's an island, right? There's boats everywhere. And my first job, I found it because I went into the local marine store, and there's only one on the west side of the island, which is Kona, or I should say the south side of the island. And I walked in there with a local six pack of beer, like day two of being on the island, getting off the plane. And I put it on their desk and I go, so who needs help around here? Because I'm looking for a job. And they basically looked at me kind of funny because, you know, here's this kid from the Northeast looking for a job on the Big Island of Hawaii. And it was all kind of uphill from there. And, you know, got another job working and running a charter boat company out there, which was awesome. Did some fishing. And yeah, now I'm back in Rhode Island running boats. So
what was the draw to Hawaii originally?
You know, at the time, I enjoyed the job that I was doing, but I didn't exactly enjoy the environment that I was in, you know? So I think it was a change of pace, but it was also kind of catalyzed with a buddy of mine who I met in college, and he was kind of going back and forth with, we gotta, you know, I want to get out of here. I don't want to be, you know, we gotta go do something. So he goes, well, I'm moving to Arizona. And I'm like, good luck with that, because I'm not going to the desert. Not my thing. And then he kept on talking about it. And all of a sudden, one day he texts me. He goes, I just bought a ticket to Hawaii. Do you want to go? And he just kind of asked me as if I was, you know, like, that'd be funny if Zach would come. And I said, let me think about it. And the next morning I texted him and I said, all right, I bought my ticket. When are we leaving? You know, and that was kind of it. But I think it was a mix of just the culture out there. You know, I knew there was a really strong culture around the ocean, and everyone out there is active, right? No one's sitting inside. Everyone's out. They're either going to the gym, going for a run, you know, fishing, spear fishing, diving. So I've always kind of been attracted to those types of people. And I think that's probably part of the reason why I moved out there for sure.
Hawaii, I've been there a couple of times and I loved it so much three times now I've been to Hawaii, and I've never spent enough time there. Like every time that I go, I'm like, man, I could have spent a month here, or 2 months, or a summer, a whole year. How did you pick the place that you went? Because, I mean, Hawaii, you say Hawaii, like there's a lot of Hawaii. How did you pick an island to fly to when you know nothing about Hawaii?
Yeah, knew nothing about it. It was a little scary at the time, but my buddy who I moved there with, he had been to Kona, and a family friend of ours, who his name is Clint Sloan, he was an artist and he was out in Kona as well. And it just so happened that, you know, this was like a long lost family friend from when we lived in Laguna Beach. And I don't know if you've ever heard of the guy Weiland before.
Okay, all over Key West.
Yeah, exactly.
Stuff all over there.
Unbelievable artist. And so Clint Sloan and Weiland used to work very close together when they lived in Laguna. And so that was like, I sort of knew someone out there. You know, it's funny, I only met him once when I was out there the whole time, even though we lived in the same town.
Yeah.
So my buddy and I, we moved out there and we actually island hopped for the first week or so. And we went from Kona, which is on the Big Island of Hawaii, and then we went to Maui, Oahu, just kind of test it out. And to be honest with you, part of it was what island had the best gym for me to train at.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a weird reason, but because I knew I was going to get a job no matter what island I was on. But it was just a matter of what gym I'm going to train in. And you know, I think Kona was the right spot because Oahu is way too busy. It was very touristy, not a lot of culture. I mean, don't get me wrong, tons of culture out there, but there was it was more so the new Hawaii versus the old Hawaii, which you can find on the Big Island, you know, a little bit of a different crowd. It's a lot cheaper to live on the Big Island than it is Oahu. And then, Maui was cool. But very hot. And I'm not a hot, hot person. Hmm. You know, it's almost like some parts of it are the desert and then some parts of the jungle, but no one lives in the jungle. Everyone lives towards the coast and like the deserty environment. So yeah, Kona was the right move. I wouldn't change it for anything.
So man, that sounds cool. When you were doing that island hopping, how do you do that? By boat, by plane, by what?
Well, it's funny. Like when I first moved there, I was thinking, oh, you can boat from island to island, right? Not the case.
Yeah.
Right. They're like, you know, I think the distance from Maui to the Big Island was like 40 miles, which on the East Coast, right, going 40 miles on a boat really isn't a big deal. You know, you guys commute to the Bahamas all the time down right. there.
But it's not 4,000 feet deep.
It's not 4,000 feet deep. Right. And that's the thing, like the strait between Maui and the Big Island is one of the most dangerous, or like the top three in the world. So you're pretty secluded on whatever island you get on. But yeah, you just, I hopped on a plane and it was an airline called Mokulele. And, you know, coming from the mainland where a typical airline is, you know, you show up, there's a security, there's baggage claim, right? No, no, no. You just hop on this plane, you hand the pilot your bag and he throws it in the bottom of the plane. And then you're hopping on with, like, I think there's like, you know, there's dogs. Some people bring like chickens and stuff on this plane and we'll fly from each and every island.
Is that before 9/11 or after 9/11?
No, this is definitely after 9/11.
After, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Because that's how it was. I mean, everything that you just described, basically, that's how you would go to Key West. I mean, it was
right.
It was really, really lax and low key and people were just, you know, sitting everywhere and the airport was really, really bare bones. And,
yeah, like nothing, right?
Yeah, a lot of things changed. I mean, I even remember the Jackson Hole Airport was you know, pretty bare bones. I mean, they had like a giant open door where the skis would come through and just all the luggage would just come through there. There wasn't
right.
like a conveyor belt or anything like you see in an airport now. It's just like, you know, you just kind of pick it up and take off. And nobody's checking
right. You
to
have
see
a
if
beer
you got
with
the right
pilot.
Bag.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
A lot of things change like that, but I guess not in Hawaii or Alaska. Like the Alaska Bush pilot. I mean, that's like a taxi cab up there.
Right.
You know, it's like an Uber. I mean, you just jump on a plane, go anywhere.
Hop on the plane.
Yeah, it's cool. That's a cool culture. So why? Well, I know I want to get into a couple of other things with you, but why? After how long did you spend in Hawaii?
Well, so, you know, I lived in Hawaii for just about a year
okay.
and then COVID came, right?
Oh.
And then it was all kind of down. Yeah. So this was fairly recent, you know, and COVID came and, you know, it just decimated the tourist population, right? The tourism on the island, everything stems from tourism, right? Mm-hmm. So even carpenters and electricians were kind of getting off the island because if the vacation rentals aren't running and they're not full, then all of a sudden you're not going to have, you know, work to maintain them. Right. So it wasn't just people that were working directly in tourism. Indirectly, there was a huge ripple effect throughout the island.
Yeah.
Right. Which is really unfortunate. So I decided that, you know, I know that I'm going to be able to work back here in Rhode Island. And I decided to come back and, you know, I think it was a good move. You know, the island, unfortunately, is pretty closed down. They're letting a lot of people in, but it's just not to the extent that it was mm-hmm. before, you know.
So when COVID hits, was there any thought that you might get stuck over there? Because the reason I ask is because
yeah.
right about, well, it was about this time last year, my son, who's in Montana, and his girlfriend, they were like, mm-hmm. we're going to take a trip and we're thinking about going to Hawaii. And it just... I mean, we were just seeing the very beginnings of COVID, and I was like, you know, I don't know if that's a good idea. I mean, I think mm-hmm. you should definitely go to Hawaii, but maybe just not right now. Like, let's see what happens here, because I mean, the writing was on the wall. Like, you could go over there and they weren't going to let you leave, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Or, I mean, you didn't know what was going to happen, right? Like, it
right.
was a weird time. Did you think,
so weird.
Was it ever, and I had a kid from Key West on the podcast, and he went to Fiji about the same time that you went to Hawaii, and he got stuck there, and he's still there.
Really?
I mean, yeah, pretty much. I think that he likes it there, he's met a girl there, but I think that he basically got stuck. Like, they said, nobody in, nobody out. Like, that's how we're going to protect ourselves here. And I mean, maybe he could go, but if he went, then he couldn't come back. Like, I don't know.
Right.
It's kind of a weird time. Did you ever have any thoughts that you might not be able to get back, or you had to make a move? Like, there was a window of time that you had to make a move?
Yeah, you know, obviously looking back on it and how it all kind of played out, it definitely didn't, unfortunately, it didn't go that route. But having been, you know, thrust into, oh no, that the world is, you know, shutting down and there's a pandemic and you're just, no one knows what's going to happen, right? The National, I'm getting calls from New England saying the National Guard's getting deployed to the borders. And I'm like, holy crap,
yeah.
what's going on in the mainland? Meanwhile, we're drinking, you know, pina coladas on the beach and like playing with sea turtles. Like, it's funny, like the culture in Hawaii, people refer to, when you live there, they refer to the mainland as the States, right? They refer to it as as America, like they're going to America. And when they first said that, they were like, I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, it's, and then I kind of realized it's just, Hawaii is its own country, really is, you know, which is very cool because it keeps the culture there. But when I first kind of got word of it, you know, it was, my parents had actually just come out and visited. So I toured them around. We took them out on the boat and just had an awesome time. And meanwhile, it was kind of this simmer on the back burner of, oh no, like we're hearing things about the pandemic, but we're not really sure. And then when they went back, they were like, oh wow, this is like, there's no food in the grocery stores. Like, this is kind of strange. So there was definitely a feeling of, oh crap, like, what if the boats don't come and supply food to the island, right? Because, you know, there's some days where you'd go to the grocery store and they just don't have things, you know, because the boat didn't come, right? And Hawaii is not self-sustainable for a lot of reasons. So yeah, there was definitely a weird feeling of, oh, you know, maybe this could go really, really bad. Or because you're on an island, it could be really, really good, you know?
I mean, so, Hawaii, I would think would, you know, I mean, there's a lot of people living there, but I would think that Hawaii would be a pretty good place to try to survive off the land. I mean, you got lots of wildlife, you've got lots of fish, you've got lots of fresh water. Like, there's a lot of good things in Hawaii. I don't know. It's like, that's why it's like a paradise, because it's got all of that. And so many of the things that I saw in Hawaii, and I have just barely scratched the surface, but I was like, oh man, you could go hiking, you could go camping, you could go to a waterfall, you could go surfing, you could go, you know, you catch a marlin right off the beach. I mean, it's just an incredible place. I really hope to spend more time there. My daughter has a fondness for it for some reason. She's never been, but she wants to go. And she has always been drawn to, like, Hawaii and Fiji and these South Pacific places. I swear she's going to live there one day. But I don't know. There's a draw to that place. And there's also, like, the other thing that I've talked about a bunch of times on the podcast is the feeling that I got when I got to Hawaii was a similar feeling that I got when I was in Yellowstone, or every time I go to Yellowstone. And I think it's the volcano, man, because you're just like, there's an energy there that is, it's hard to describe if somebody hasn't been to a place like that. But
you
kind of feel the same kind of energy when you get on top of a mountain or something, and you're just like it's just, it's hard to describe, but I've definitely felt it strong in Hawaii, strong in Yellowstone. And I would only assume that it's, you know, the Earth's core is right there. Like, that's got to do something, you know,
for sure.
Did you feel that? Like, Hawaii's a powerful place. Did you kind of feel that power?
Oh God. Yeah. Hawaii is, it's powerful. It's like, it's very majestic. And it's hard to describe, you know, it really is. But, you know, there's when you're driving down a road, right, the Hawaiians say there's Mauna and Makai, right? Makai being the ocean side and Mauna being the mountain side. And it's kind of this, you know, juxtaposition of these two major entities kind of coming together, right? Mm-hmm. And you're in the middle of nowhere. So you almost question, like, how did you even get out here, right? Like, how did this beautiful paradise come out of the ocean, out of a volcano, and create this just magical place? I mean, on the Big Island alone, it has almost every single, I guess you could say, like environmental, or every single environment you can imagine, right? You can go to the top of Mauna Kea and you could be in 3 feet of snow,
right?
You know, and go snowboarding. And then you could, you know, stroll yourself down the mountain and go surfing. And like you said, you can go catch a marlin from the shore. I mean, some of these guys here on the East Coast, right, they spend thousands, if not millions of dollars on these big sport fishing boats. Meanwhile, you got, you know, some Hawaiian guy in a skiff hand lining, catching these beautiful fish, right? Yeah, I think there's definitely something to be said about having lived out there and even visiting, you know. So what island did you visit, Tom, when you were out there?
The Big Island. And
oh, awesome.
Yeah, that's the only place I've been. Yeah. So we just kind of saw what we could see. Both times, or three times now, I've been there. I was on a stopover going to Christmas Island to go fishing. And when I took my boys on this last trip, I was like, you know, last time we didn't spend almost any time. It was basically an overnight in Hawaii, and then you take off. So this time we spent like 4 or 5 days. And we just looked around, and we didn't have any agenda or anything. We just kind of explored around. And I had a friend that was in the Marines, and he knew a little bit about Hawaii. He was stationed there. And so he gave me a few places to go check out, which were all amazing. But, I mean, it was just like going to any amazing place. Like Yellowstone's a good example. You don't have to know anything about Yellowstone to be blown away. Like, you don't have to have, like, inside information. Oh, you should go here, you know, or there. You just stop anywhere, and it's amazing. Yeah. And that was our experience in Hawaii. And both my boys felt the same way. They were like, man, I don't know how or when, but I'm coming back here and going to spend some time, you know? So that's cool. My friend, or my son's best friend, is now stationed in Hawaii. And so I think that was one of the reasons why he was going to go last year, so he could see his buddy. So hopefully he'll get over there before his time on Hawaii runs out with the military. But man, what a great place. So one of the things that you kind of glossed over there was that you were looking for an island that you had a gym. And you know, so when you first came onto the Waypoint Outdoor Collective, you know, somebody sent me, like, this is the new podcast that's on here. And I checked out the podcast. I'm like, yeah, this is pretty cool, you know, like, got some stuff here. And then I looked at your personal thing, and I was like, oh, man, okay, here, this is a different thing than I thought. And dude, you are a very accomplished lifter. And so I'm interested in how that started, like, and you're a competitive lifter now, like in the Olympic lifts, or do you do powerlifting? I saw some strongman on there. What's your story with the lifting?
Well, it's funny you ask that, because it's not something I get to talk about a lot, you know, but it's a passion of mine that it's been ingrained in me ever since I was a kid, you know. And my parents, they lived in California, Southern California, during a time where it was just at the end of the golden age of bodybuilding, right? And kind of in the beginning Muscle Beach, right? Venice Beach, and, you know, kind of this epicenter for fitness in the United States, and, you know, arguably in the world.
Right.
And, you know, so growing up, I remember watching Pumping Iron when I was when I was 10, right?
Yeah, me too.
And you know, having Arnold movies was, you know, every Friday night it was, you know, sitting down and watching an Arnie movie, you know, and no matter what. So I think I probably saw Predator when I was in like kindergarten or something like that.
But might have been a bad idea at the time.
Might have been a bad idea. But and that was the thing to do, right? So it was always something to see, you know, guys like Arnold and Columbo and, you know, I can't remember his name. Tom Platz, you know, like all these names. Lou Ferrigno, another incredible bodybuilder with an incredible story behind him as well.
And then Stallone turned into a bodybuilder boxer.
Yeah.
More of a bodybuilder than a boxer, but I don't know. I mean, he put on a pretty impressive physique, you know,
he still does. I mean, I think he's like what, 70 now?
Yeah.
Or something?
No, I mean, yeah. But you know, back in the day, like Rocky III, Rocky IV.
Dude, yeah,
he was looking pretty tight.
He's a beast. Yeah, for sure. So, you know, having grown up kind of with that mentality, you know, my mom was a semi-professional bodybuilder. So growing up, you know, school lunches weren't, you know, going and getting a sandwich, right? It was chicken and rice in a Tupperware. And you know, make sure you're eating your kale and spinach and
stuff
like that.
What are you having, Zach? You don't really want it.
No one wanted to trade with me. I always imagine, you know, that I've seen Billy Madison,
yeah,
right? When he's like, you know, I can kick your ass if you want that snack pack, you know, with the pudding. yeah, so, you know, growing up, that was the thing to do. Whereas other families were going to, you know, going to sporting events, it was, we're going to the gym, you know? And
so when you went there as a little kid, are you drawn to like the Olympic lifting? Are you drawn to the bodybuilding kind of, type of workouts, or
mm-hmm.
How did that kind of materialize into what you're doing today?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I guess it really kind of, there's an evolution, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when I first started out, it was always, you know, bodybuilding, you know, hypertrophy work. You know, you're in that, you know, 8 to 10,
yeah,
12 set range, or rep range, I should say. So, and then it kind of grew, you know, and as my interest kind of changed, I was always enamored by, you know, strongmen, right? Loved watching it. I can remember being in a hotel. I think I was like 8 years old, and there was Strongman World Championship came on, and there was Marius Pujanowski, Brian Shaw, Zdrunas Zvikas. And they were all competing, and I was just sitting there, and everyone else went away. Like, they went upstairs, and I was just watching it, staring at these guys picking up cars and logs. And I was like, oh man, that's badass. Like, you know, at 8 years old, I was like, I want to do that one day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I actually hadn't done my first strongman competition until this past summer in June. But, you know, from bodybuilding, I got into CrossFit, you know, for a long time, actually, and throughout high school. And I competed in CrossFit, and I actually got so close to going to when they opened up the teen division. I think it was 2000. I don't know. I can't remember what it was, but anyway, I was close to actually going to the games.
Mm-hmm.
But there was like I was a month too old to go. Mm. So I don't know. I always say I probably could have gone, but I don't know. You never know if you actually do, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, and it's funny. So when I was going through your stuff, Tom, and watching a lot of the videos, I stumbled upon Fitter TV, you know, and it jogged my memory that there was an interview that you did with Dan Bailey and Rich Froning, and you were at Texas Tech University.
Yeah, or Tennessee Tech.
Tennessee Tech, yeah. And I can remember watching that video like mm-hmm. 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And being like, oh man, Rich Froning is a badass, you know, like, and that was kind of, he was kind of an idol at that time. But yeah, so it was kind of funny. It was like a major deja vu, you
yeah.
know, seeing that video. I was like, oh my God, this is, this is the guy that made the video. And I'm talking to him. It's just kind of funny. But yeah. And then all of a sudden, you know, I got injured, I in CrossFit, and just, it wasn't really an injury. It was just some nagging things. And I decided, you know, I was going to college at the time and I wanted to join a team, you know, and I'm not really a sports guy. I enjoy sport. I like watching sports and whatnot, but I like training more than I do actually competing, to be mm-hmm. honest with you. I like that. I like the journey. And powerlifting, they had a powerlifting team at URI, and not a lot of colleges had that. So it was convenient that I was in Rhode Island with a powerlifting team. So might as well go to URI. And yeah, I'll tell you what, that was an incredible decision to be on that team.
Yeah.
I mean,
so for people that don't know, I mean, not mm-hmm. everybody knows as much about lifting as you or maybe even me, but explain the difference between powerlifting, Olympic lifting, and then just regular lifting.
Sure. Yeah. So I guess if you're a recreational lifter and you're going to the gym to get in shape, right? You know, you're going in because you want to hit a certain heart rate and maybe put on some muscle, you're probably doing hypertrophy work, and you might throw in a certain, maybe a strength cycle every once in a while. But that's very recreational. Like, you don't have the intention of competing.
Mm-hmm.
Powerlifting is you're kind of, you're narrowing your focus, right? So you're focusing on the big three, which is the squat, the bench, and the deadlift, or the or SBD, right? And you're just trying to get as heavy as possible. And when you go to a competition, basically you have three attempts for each lift. So you can go 9 for 9, which is getting all of them. And you can actually, you know, if you go, let's say for the squat, you know, you take three attempts. If you miss your second, well, then you can have another third. And if you don't miss the, if you don't take the third, then, you know, you got to move on. So it's basically that who can lift the most within those three lifts within this given amount of time. Olympic lifting is similar to powerlifting in the sense that instead of having three lifts, there's only two lifts. And those two lifts are the snatch and the clean and jerk. And that's primarily what they, you know, at the Olympics, that's what it's known for. Mm-hmm. So if you're a Olympic lifter, you know, you're more commonly called a weightlifter. You know, I think people kind of mix that up a little bit. They're like, what do you do? And I'm like, I'm a weightlifter. I do weightlifting. And they're like, oh, that's cool. So, and they think of that as like the general like sense of just lifting. like bodybuilding, totally different. Right. Yeah. And weightlifting, right. You have the snatch from the clean and jerk. You get three attempts in each at a competition. And the cool thing about that is the bar never gets lighter. Right. So it's always getting heavier. And it kind of, you can kind of play games with other people during the competition. So it's not necessarily just who lifts the most, but it's who lifts the most within this given amount of time, you know? And then strongman is just a variety of different lifting where, you know, picking up cars, farmer's walks, like all sorts of cool stuff.
Yeah. So
Atlas stones. Yeah.
Yokes, mm-hmm. all kinds of stuff. Did you ever run into, do you know who Rob Orlando is?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, I have one of his shirts, Hybrid Athletics.
Yeah, me too. I did a couple of shows with him. He's a really cool guy. He had an interesting thing going on where he was kind of bringing strongman into CrossFit. And I went up there and did a Fitness Truth episode with him, and he taught me how to do the Atlas stones and do a lot of the strongman stuff that he was doing, and mm-hmm. and just kind of how that translated into regular lifting and how it translated into – you know, CrossFit type competitions and mm-hmm. how it just translated into just pure strength that would translate across everything that you're doing. Yeah. And he's a cool dude, man. I really liked him. But, you know, as a wrestler, that's kind of, you know, strongman is similar to wrestling in that you're lifting an odd object
mm-hmm.
and you're expected to do it, you know, repeatedly over and over and over again. And so some of the strongman stuff, because your hips are involved and all of that, some of the strongman stuff came easier than, say, the snatch has come for me. You know, that's mm-hmm. the snatch is like a golf swing. It's mm-hmm. it is, you watch somebody that's really good at it, you're like, I don't think that guy's that much stronger than me. And maybe they're not, but their technique mm-hmm. is so good. Or a girl, like so many of these girls right now.
Oh my God.
They weigh 120 pounds and they're snatching, you know, 240, and it's like what, like how?
It's
like,
crazy.
I'm not even think you could deadlift that, but so this pursuit. When did you start as a kid going from kind of the bodybuilding into any of these pursuits of like you watch that strongman on TV? Did you get some sort of coaching that was, you know, for the Olympic lifts or for the powerlifting, or did you just kind of go in at on your own or what?
Yeah. So I think when things started to become more formalized, and also a side note, I also wrestled in high school mm-hmm. too. So like I can totally agree with the strongman and how the transitions very well. But yeah, it started to get serious with lifting and competing and traveling and really trying to make a go at it and doing some pretty cool things. Probably when I got injured, which resulted in me going into Olympic weightlifting. You know, I had coaches in powerlifting, but when you're on the powerlifting team in college, there's a lot of self-coaching, you know, from the guys. Like you're learning from the older guys and they're kind of, you know, throwing things on you and you're kind of teaching them. But, you know, I guess my first coach would be Anthony Iannero when I was young, and he was my mom's bodybuilding coach. And then for the powerlifting, I got somewhat coached by a guy named Dr. Michael Pepin, who is a CPT, and he actually has his diplomat now. So that's like you got your doctorate and you have your diplomat. Mm. It's like the level above. I didn't even know that was a thing. Told me.
In what? Like, and what's his diplomat in what?
I don't want to butcher it, but it's like chiropractic in sports rehabilitation or exercise science.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
She's got some cool equipment there. But then, you know, when I got injured, basically in powerlifting, I had a partial groin tear, and just kind of being stupid, not really paying attention. And from there, I was like, all right, well, I got to keep moving forward here. So I actually met Dr. Michael Pepin, who's here in Rhode Island. And from there, he kind of broke me down. I mean, literally like picked everything apart. And it was super, super humbling because he's doing it in front of everyone that was there, you know. And you know, at the time, right, it's I was working, I was going to school, and I would go up to this place at like 8 o'clock at night, and I wouldn't leave until 11 o'clock sometimes. And then during the mornings, before I'd go to class, I'd drive up, which was a 45 minute ride. I'd wake up at 4:30, and I'd go for the 5 a.m like the 5 a.m little session that we'd put together just for the people that wanted the lift. So, you know, a few years went by, and basically I was feeling better. You know, my groin was a lot, you know, in a much healthier place. And this guy comes in, and, his name is Dave, and Dave is like this big bearded dude, and he had Chacos on, which, you know, I'm like, what is this guy wearing, you know, sandals for in Rhode Island? And, so I watched him snatch and clean and jerk, and I'm like, man, that's really, really cool. And I knew about Olympic lifting. Like, I had watched some of the Bulgarian stuff, and, you know, through CrossFit, you kind of indirectly get introduced to it, which is pretty cool. Like what Mike Bergner did for the community. But basically from there, I was like, hey doc, like, what is that guy doing? I kind of want to do that. Like, that looks cool. Powerlifting is great, but everyone can squat, bench, and deadlift, you know, like, no matter who you are, you can go into a gym and you can squat, bench, and deadlift. Now, there's only a select group of people that know how to snatch and clean and jerk. Mm-hmm. And there's a really small amount of people that can snatch and clean and jerk really well, you know? So Dr. Pepin was like, yeah, we can go through do that. And he kind of introduced me to it, taught me the sport. He led me up to my first competition. And at my first competition, unfortunately, he couldn't go. So basically I got sent on my own, you know. I had competed in powerlifting. I was like, all right, well, it's probably the same thing. not even close, right? Totally different structure to the meet. And sure as shit, guess who walks in? It was Big Dave with the beard and the Chacos. And I'm like, huh, that's interesting. So he walks in and he's like, oh, you're Pepin's kid. And I'm like, yeah, you know, I'm just first comp. He's like, all right, well, if you need help, let me know. So I start warming up and I have no idea what I'm doing. Like, Olympic lifting is very much so, like, there's a recipe that you have to follow. And if you don't follow it, you're probably not going to do well.
Right.
So Dave, he looks at me as I'm warming up and he goes, so, is this your first meet? I'm like, yeah, I have no idea what I'm doing. He goes, all right, well, let me help you out. So basically he took me under his wing and, you know, coached me through the entire meet, you know, and I never really met him, like, only on a handshake. And then after that, he goes, Zach, you know, if you want to learn more, because I know you're limited at Pepin's because there was only certain times we could train because of the, you know, some of the timing with other businesses around, we couldn't drop heavy weights. And he invited me to come to Providence Barbell Club, which is where I'm now, you know.
Yeah.
I just started training with him.
Super cool.
Yeah, right? It's awesome.
Yeah.
It's so cool.
A big open air place with old bricks, mm-hmm. and it looks really, really super cool. And then you can hear in the back of your videos that you got to support team behind you, like people that are into it and know what's going on. That's got to be a really, you know, I love places like that bring a certain energy to this environment of, I mean, it could be a wrestling room, it could be a jiu-jitsu mm-hmm. place, it could be a boxing gym, but like you go into one of these places and you're like, man, work gets done here. Like,
yeah,
this is an intense place. It could be a marina, you know, you go to go to certain marinas and there's like 10 of the top guides there and you're like, whoa, like
right.
this is the real deal right here. And that's what that gym that, you know, when I look at your videos,
yeah.
that looks like that,
yeah.
that place, some work gets done in there.
Yeah. I love that gym. I mean, when I was competing for them and then I moved to Hawaii and I did some satellite coaching.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a competition out in San Francisco, but then when I moved back here, you know, there's nothing like being in the home field advantage, you know, and being in a gym where everyone's there for the same goal.
Right.
So Yeah, love Province Barbell
and so,
Club.
When you say everybody's there for the same goal, like how many competitions would someone generally compete in? I mean, my experience with Olympic lifting is all centered around CrossFit. So mm-hmm. I don't know this world. It's an interesting world, but like how many, what's a healthy kind of competition schedule for somebody like you that's got a job, but you're good at this. So how many times do you compete a year?
Well, I think prior to COVID, right? It was, let's see, I'd probably do about 3, maybe 4 a year, maybe. Where there was probably one tune-up meet, which is like a local meet, you know, and then you might do another local meet, but really you're paying attention to the big meets, which in Olympic weightlifting is the American Open. Mm-hmm. So there's the American Open finals and then there's the American Open series. The series events are kind of the beginner, not the beginner meets, but the intermediate, like to the American Open finals. And then from finals, you have nationals, and from nationals, you have the Pan Ams and all these other meets that you can go up and up and up, mm-hmm. like the Worlds and, you know, the Olympics being the last and final, like the boss at the end of the video game type things, the Olympics. Right. Yeah, so I'd say like, I usually typically compete like 3 or 4 times a year. And then there's always like a few big meets mixed in. This year, because of COVID, I got to do a strongman meet. That was kind of my, you know, I have to do something. I have to train towards something. So I did that. And then from there, it's all been leading up to this competition, which is coming up in, well, next week, next Sunday.
Hmm.
So.
And so what about the weight classes? Where do you compete? How big are you?
So I am 5'6", and I weigh 94 kilos, which is right around 208.
You're 5'6", 208.
Yep, roughly.
Pretty stocky, dude. and so, man, I watched you front squat. It was like over 400 pounds, I think. It was 196 kilos. Yep. That's 400 and what? 400 and?
Like 430.
430. So you got a 430 front squat at 200 pounds. Yep. More than double body weight. And then what's your snatch?
So my snatch is my arch enemy, right? I snatch 110 right now, which is like 245.
Okay.
And then my clean and jerk is right around 150 kilos, so 330. And then my back squat right now, I did a double at 210. So I'm estimating that I could probably do about 215 for a max, which is like 480 or something like that.
Wow. So when did you there's like regular strong and you know, like you're kind of strong among your friends and stuff like that. And then, you know, when you get your technique down and you start to get stronger and you make like this big jump, like there was obviously a big jump there mm-hmm. when you started getting coaching and everything. When did you kind of notice like, okay, I'm moving some like real weight? Like you start talking about, you know, you're front squatting 300 pounds. That raises some eyebrows. And then you go over 400 pounds. You're like, that's pretty good. I mean, that's pretty good. You know, like, so, I mean, at what point did you make a big jump, or has this been a gradual process the whole time?
Oh man. Well, I think there's two ways to look at it, right? There's a big jump in knowledge and maturity when it comes to lifting. And then there's a big jump in, you know, how much you can lift. Right. And one definitely does not live without the other. Right. And for me, getting a coach and really diving into what it means to be an athlete, you know, and not just someone who likes to train, was a huge jump in knowledge and maturity. I mean, I learned so much from being around Dr. Michael Pepin and my coach, Jared Smith. And then, you know, my coach, Dave Ethier right now, just having that knowledge and those people that you can look to, was a huge jump in my eyes, you know?
So when you're getting this knowledge,
mm-hmm.
what is the kind of, when you look at it, what is the take home? Is it that you weren't doing enough work, that you were doing it incorrectly, or that you weren't even coming close to testing yourself? like you know, there's some people like me, I like to train. like you. And in a lot of ways, I hold myself back because I like to train too much. And so a lot of people look at the programming and they're like, man, if you took a little more rest, you know, and you didn't do this stuff and this stuff and this stuff, you'd probably make some big jumps. Like what was it for you when you get the coaching? Was it not enough, too much, or you need to do it in a different way?
Yeah. Well, honestly, Tom, like I was, you know, having done CrossFit, right? It's kind of in the culture that like the more work you do, the better you're going to get, you know, in a lot of ways. You know, I think that definitely holds true in some ways, but you know, the biggest for me was definitely recovery. You know, you gotta train hard and you gotta recover harder, you know? And then the other thing was there's no right way to do things. There's only better ways to do things. Right. So, you know, you got the bar over your head and you did a snatch. Great. But was it the best technique? You know, was it the best way to do it without possibly getting injured? You know, so things like that, I think were definitely added a lot of value to my training, and especially the recovery, you know, because I'm someone that, you know, I like to work, you know, whether it's me building my own business and podcast, whether it's working for someone else, whether it's in the gym, I like to work, you know, and that's always been a struggle for me, is trying to dial that back a little bit and be like, all right, instead of focusing on, you know, running and CrossFit and Olympic lifting and powerlifting, we're just going to focus on Olympic lifting and get really, really good. And then if we want to kind of ease back on the cycle of Olympic lifting and kind of add in some, you know, bench press, some strongman, that's going to help, you know, down the road to make you a better Olympic lifter. Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing I learned, was this is a long game. Olympic lifting is like the longest game you're ever going to play. You know, we literally program a year in advance, pretty much, you know? So like right now we're building out a program that's going to be implemented throughout the next year or so. That's going to lead up to hopefully the AO finals, maybe 2021, but even 2022 is kind of what we're looking at. So like, this is such a long game.
Wow. And then and that's all based on percentages of tested maxes and stuff like that. So when you don't hit that, then you have to restructure everything and kind of go back to building that base up a little bit more and restructure all of your, that's a cool thing, man. So
yeah.
What about, I know we're going to get to your podcast here in a minute.
No, I love talking about lifting. Trust me.
I know you do. I do too. But maybe not everybody that listens to it. They're like, God dang, man, when are we going to get back to fishing? But anyway, so what about mobility and flexibility? Like, that's one thing that a lot of people don't realize with especially the Olympic lifting, man. You look at these guys in the Olympics, and most of them could probably just drop into a split right there. Like, they are really amazingly flexible. Did you work on that with your coaches? Did they start to work? I mean, like the snatch and the clean and jerk, I mean, they're impossible lifts if you don't have good ankle mobility and hip mobility.
Yeah.
And I mean, you have to be able to get into these positions, and you have to be able to do it well. And a lot of people don't have that at first. Like, what was your journey to mobility? How much time do you spend on that?
Well, you know, that's always another one of my arch enemies is mobility, right? Because it's one of those things that it's those little things that you do that the most successful people are doing consistently. And you know, if you're someone like me, mobility has never been my thing. Some people are really into it.
Yeah, but you're also really young.
Like, yeah, there's that too. Yeah. And I biomechanically, with my height and my ratios, weightlifting is more catered towards me versus someone who's really tall and lanky. Mm-hmm. Right. But with that, I'm pretty tight, you know, like my hamstrings are pretty tight, my hips are tight. So I'm constantly trying to do stretching and mobility and recovery. Epsom salt baths have been pretty, you know, just an awesome way for me to recover at night. You know, I do those like twice a week. And then, you know, stretching every day. I try and stretch no matter what. I definitely stretch before I train. And then after I train, just some light stretching with heavy stretching after, do some dynamic warmups just to kind of get some sort of sweat and some blood flow before I train. And then either later in the night or earlier in the day, I'll do some mobility stuff as well. So for me, it's a lot of my quads, my hamstrings, and then my ankles are what usually bog me down, just because we, as Olympic lifters, you put so much load on your posterior chain that you gotta do something about it, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's really impressive to see somebody. I put something on my story yesterday. It was Noah Olson, and he was doing some snatch work.
And man, I saw that. Yeah,
he was shooting down into his lowest squat position in that snatch. I mean, so much so, and it was funny because he's been on the podcast, and mm-hmm. I've trained with him a number of times, and he's a good dude, and we stay in touch. And I shared that on my story, and almost immediately he got back. Hey man, thanks for sharing. That's cool. And sent me a little note, and I was like, man, have you been working on that bottom position? Because that was, I mean, he was dropping into it so forcefully. It looked like he had just gained some serious mobility, like a newfound ability. He was like, I've been working on my ankle flexibility a little bit, but
yeah,
you know, I don't know. I don't think that was that challenging of a weight for Noah, but it's really impressive to see really big, strong people with incredible flexibility, like Juju Mufu. That dude,
yeah, that dude's insane.
Unbelievable, man. He can
doing splits
just,
and shit.
Yeah, chair splits with like 185 overhead, and he just drops into a split. But it goes to show you, like, a lot of people have kind of associated a big, strong guy with somebody mm-hmm. that's super tight, and you know, you see the Olympic lifters and somebody like Juju Mufu, who has this amazing Instagram that's hilarious, by the way, if you want a good follow. And he is so flexible. I mean, he calls himself the anabolic acrobat because he just does all of these crazy, crazy things with his body, but it's all flexibility. And
he's a beast too. I mean, he is a strong dude.
He's a strong dude.
He front squatted like 500 pounds the other day or so, or like last week.
Well, he just comes in there and does three back flips and then deadlifts like 700 pounds, you know?
Yeah.
And then does a back flip and runs off the stage and, you know, does whatever. But he's an amazing guy. And I think that, you know, it seems like he's able to train, hard and consistently and remain really strong and injury free. And that's mm-hmm. been something that I've been really working on this year, is way more stretching. I mean, I'm stretching like 2 hours a day, and it has been, it has been really remarkable. Now, I don't think that I'm going to have to continue to stretch 2 hours a day, but there's this period where if you've been neglecting it, there's only one way to get it back. And that's a lot of time. And I've been spending a tremendous amount of time, and I'm noticing big differences. But if I have a 2 hour session, the next day in training is it feels like I wound the clock back 20 years. It is amazing. And I just the way I walk up and down the stairs, the way that I walk around all day is like, wow. Like, I feel like, you know, like all my joints have been lubricated. And it's, I don't know, the guy that I'm following here, this Joe Hippensteel, he says it's the fountain of youth, that stretching is the fountain of youth, and particularly the way that he does it. And I tend to believe it, man. But it's also very, very, very easy to neglect because it's horrendous and painful and awful.
Oh, my God, it's so bad.
I mean,
it
is literally like the worst thing in the world when you're doing it.
I hate it.
But then after, it's so good. It's like one of those things where, you know, like with your diet or something, like, it's almost the opposite. It's like, you know, you eat that ice cream, it's so good going down. But then for the rest of the day, maybe even
feels
the rest
like crap
of the week, you're like, man, why did I do that? I don't. But you just can't help it. When it's right in front of you, you want it. And stretching is like the opposite. It is horrible and terrible for those 2 or 3 minutes or whatever you're spending in this position. And then for the rest of the day, for the rest of the week, for the rest of the month, you're glad you did it. But man, you don't want to do it. I mean, it's a terrible, thing.
Yeah, stretching has never been. I would much rather do a 10x10 on the back squat or like a max 10 than
like
stretch.
Anything like,
oh my God,
waterboarding, you know, anything like whatever. It is really bad. But then, you know, once you kind of get to it, then all of a sudden that position gets a little bit easier and a little bit easier and a little bit easier. But if you're if you're really going after it, then you're just seeking that next level of whatever it is. So you're going deeper or using a sandbag or something. I don't know. But that has been really, really great for me. Cool, man. Well, your lifting is awesome. So where do you hope to go with it? You hope to go to the Pan Ams or taking it as far as you can? And are you going to stick just to Olympic lifting, or are you kind of up for whatever at this point?
You know, it's funny. So I was having this conversation with my coach, who we're pretty close, and well, I'm close with both my coaches. And, you know, I was calling him up last night, and we're constantly throwing videos back and forth of like, the Bulgarians and different coaches. And recently I've been on the Sean Waxman kick, who's out in California. I haven't heard of Sean Waxman before.
I don't know him.
Yeah, he's unbelievable weightlifting coach. His gym is actually probably the oldest weightlifting.
What's it called?
Gym.
I might know the gym.
Waxman's gym.
Okay, no, I don't know it.
No. But yeah, he's like the modern Mike Bergner, you know, who I got to meet at a meet. Awesome dude too.
Yeah, I've had him as a coach a couple of times in different.
Have you really?
Yeah, he's amazing. One of the things about him though that I was telling you earlier is I was amazed at how short and intense the sessions were. He was like, do this. Okay, we're done. You know? Like,
and that's it.
Yeah. And it was like, I would have gone a little bit longer, but I also wouldn't.
Was it
have
like
gone
an
quite
hour
as heavy.
Or like how long?
Well, it was like, it was when I was doing all that Fitness Truth stuff you know, I'd go up to that Reebok One and he'd be a guest coach there or a guest coach, you know, a couple times now I've run into him and, just a wonderful man. He's just a really nice guy, but he has a way that, you know, he's going to, you're going to do your front squats and you're going to do your snatches and then it's over, man. That's it. That's what you're going to do for the day. And that's probably tailored towards the CrossFit crowd, you know, to where he's just like, you know, I don't want anybody doing too much. And this is going to be pretty good for everybody here. And that's what we're going to do today. Nobody's getting hurt.
Yeah.
Nobody's, you know, I don't know.
You got to kind of dial it back a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
For sure.
Maybe. But I mean, what I came away from was that was a much shorter session than I'm used to. And it was also a little heavier. And so it's a little more intense, but a little shorter. And, you know, I would imagine that if I continue to do that, I would make some big gains. But he's a really good coach. I mean, and what he's done for the CrossFit community is amazing. And I think that has translated into the Olympic lifting community, because there's more people doing Olympic lifting now than maybe in a long time. And a lot of that is you know, his input with the CrossFit world. And then, you know, a lot of people like you, like, they get into it, they like CrossFit, but really I kind of like this lifting more. And I've seen a lot of people do that, to kind of gravitate away from CrossFit and more into the lifting. And there's a new participant in the sport, because it's kind of a, you know, it was kind of a dying sport. Like, you go to a 24/7 fitness place, you're not allowed to, you know, drop 175 pounds overhead.
Right.
You know, like, you're not allowed. They don't have space for that. And it's an insurance nightmare for those people. Like, what? You're just going to let anybody come in here and just fling weights over their head?
Weights
like,
around,
no.
Yeah.
And so for that reason, like, it's, you got to have a place like what you have, like this place that is designed for this, you're surrounded by people that are doing this activity and that's what they're interested in. Cause it doesn't mix with bodybuilding type places or, you know, a Gold's Gym or a, you know, whatever, a 24/7 kind of gym type place.
Right.
So if it wasn't for the CrossFit world and those type of gyms, who now aren't just CrossFit, like, they'll have a whole like a lifting time with a lifting coach that comes in.
Right.
And that, I would think that would tend to bring a lot more people into the sport, which could be kind of controversial to.
Yeah.
Like, what is the feeling of that in the Olympic lifting world, like the real Olympic lifting world?
Yeah. I think it goes both ways, right? There's, you know, what I see it as is CrossFit has put more barbells in people's hands and given them more opportunity to be a stronger, you know, a stronger self than any other sport ever, right? Because, I mean, a lot of people play football, but then, you know, I see it all the time. You get these old guys that played football back in high school, but now they're fat and out of shape, right? Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I used to be able to run, you know, 100 yards. Like, yeah, back when you were 16, yeah. You know? But people that are doing CrossFit, you know, you have all walks of life in there, whether you're old, young. You know, I remember the box that I was going to, you know, there's people that are 70, 80 plus going there, you know, and just doing box, you know, sitting on a box and standing up and picking up weights off the floor and just moving, right? I mean, my grandmother goes to the gym every single day and she's 88 years old, right?
That's awesome.
So it's, oh, she's a badass. Yeah. And, you know, it's like people, you know, I think put way too much emphasis on what you're doing in terms of your fitness. And yeah, I mean, I compete in Olympic weightlifting because that's my sport. But in terms of what CrossFit's done, it's made more healthy, you know, healthy individuals and at least open their minds up to other sports. Like, you know, strongman has blown up right now. I don't know if you've noticed, but in the past few years, strongman with, you know, Hafþór Bjarnason and Brian Shaw, all these guys coming on YouTube. And I think a lot of that is because of the CrossFit community.
Well, yeah, you know? Because then you look at it like one of the big supporters of that is Rogue Fitness, and Rogue mm-hmm. Fitness was born out of CrossFit, and now they have resources, and they're trying, you know, they're catering to the strongman crowd, catering, but they're also providing a platform that didn't exist before. Like, it was right. Either ESPN or nothing. And so when the strongman yeah. competitions kind of go off of ESPN, where do you see that anymore? Like, mm-hmm. I had do you know Steve Slater?
Oh, yeah.
I had him on the podcast. He was super
Did you really?
Cool. Yeah, man. He builds all those giant logs and stuff. He's a big-time fisherman. He loves fishing.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
He loves it, man. And he's a super cool guy. Love that
I
guy.
Have some of his stones in my garage.
I'm sure you do.
Yeah.
And he's got all those giant logs. You should – man, you're up there. You would love this place. He has a hardware store. Like, that's his deal, Slater's Hardware. And
no
it's
shit.
Like him and huh. his sister and his brother own this place. And each of them have, like, some sort of little hobby that they're into. His happens mm-hmm. to be strongman stuff. So you go into this hardware store, and, oh, yeah, here's the fertilizer, here's the bird feed. What is this giant log doing here? Why are there all these huge dudes in here lifting? What are they lifting? Like, everything, stones
right.
and logs and then you go over here and like one of them apparently is into like RC cars, like super into RC
really?
cars, and so they have like this whole section of all of that stuff. And then I don't know,
that's
each
too cool.
each person in the family has kind of been given the autonomy to, you know, bring whatever. And this hardware store sounded like the coolest place in the world. But
yeah.
but he builds all his stuff around there and has mm-hmm. all that stuff in there. And you might at any day walk into this obscure little hardware store and see like your strongman heroes.
Right.
Like checking out this new log and maybe possibly lifting it over their head and it weighs
yeah.
700 pounds.
Yeah.
But that guy's super cool. But it's up there somewhere around where you are. Like, I mean, the Northeast is kind of a. I kind of lump it all together because, you know, I drive from, you know, Florida to Montana. So, like, looking at that little area up there, I'm like, oh, it's all like one state.
Right.
I mean, I don't mean any disrespect. It's just nothing is very far away from somewhere else. So, like,
yeah.
Rob Orlando, he's in Connecticut. And,
yeah.
And Slater, I think he's in Connecticut, too.
Is he?
Ross Enamite. He's up that way. Man, you got a lot of strong, freaking awesome athletes up there.
It's the cold weather.
Long,
what else are you going to do?
Winter. No kidding. I mean, like you want to be out boating, but you just have to lift weights all winter.
Right. Sounds terrible. Wow. Boating and boats and barbells.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
There you go. That's the name of your new podcast. You have
there
another.
There you go. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Let's talk about your podcast for a minute, like along the keel. Like, what was – did you start this after Hawaii or before, or what's the journey on the podcast?
Yeah, so I had always – I mean, I've been obsessed with podcasts since forever, you know. And, you know, one podcast that I've listened to religiously, and I don't listen to their new stuff all that often, is Barbell Shrugged,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know you guys – you know
– Mike.
Not –
Mike
yeah,
Bledsoe,
Mike.
When Mike was there, I listened to it
yeah.
a bunch.
Okay, yeah. And then who's the guy that you had on? Well, he was on Fitter TV. during that video with Rich Froning and Dan Bailey going at it together. He's a part of the Barbell Shrug team. I just can't remember his
And I had him on the podcast?
Name. No, he was on your fitter. I don't know if you had him on the podcast.
Let's see. I don't know who that would be.
He's a younger guy.
Yeah. A guy from Memphis. Yeah, that's where all that kind of started out.
Right.
Yeah. I can't remember who that was.
I can't remember his name.
He was like pretty top level CrossFit athlete at the time. Mm-hmm. I don't remember who that was.
Yeah. But so anyway, you know, listening to him, Chris Moore was a big influence too. Listening to his podcast, Barbell Buddha. And, you know, my thing was I love the gym, you know, and I love training, but I also have this thing which not a lot of people know about, right? Which is the ocean and being a captain and working on the water. And, you know, it's kind of a career that is interesting to a lot of people. You know, I think a lot of the times things get romanticized, you know, when they're around the ocean, but then they don't actually realize that there's a lot of hardworking men and women that are on the water day in and day out, you know, building brands, companies, organizations that kind of revolve around the ocean, you know, in the outdoors. So when I thought about it, I'm like, well, you know, where can I kind of give my two cents? You know, how can I provide a platform for people? And it's funny, I was at a friend's wedding, and I actually just talked to her last night, and she got married in Fayetteville, North Carolina, because her husband is a Green Beret. And basically in this hotel, I sat down on my laptop and I'm like, I'm going to start a podcast. So I started like recording my voice onto GarageBand, and I was like, my voice sounds terrible. I can't do this. So then I just put it away, you know, and then a year later, I had moved to Hawaii. I was, you know, a captain out there, and it always kind of been marinating in my head as to this is kind of what I wanted to do. And I always got interested in media and in just sharing stories with people, whether it's video, podcasts, blogs, whatever. So, you know, long story short, I created three episodes of what was called Beyond the Buoy, you know, at the time. And then that's a whole nother side story that we don't need to get into. But I created these three episodes just thinking, let's just throw it out there, see what happens. And they were friends of mine. You know, I think two of them I had just met. And then one of them was an oyster farmer here in Narragansett Bay who I've known forever. And, you know, the first few days, I think I got like 25 downloads, and then it kind of spun off from there. And I was like, all right, well, I'll make another one, see what happens. And then that one got like 100 downloads, and I'm like, oh, this is kind of interesting. So I kind of went with it, you know. And when COVID hit, I had like four or five episodes, and that was kind of it. You know, I didn't really have any intentions to build it as to where it is now. But when COVID came and I left, and I was kind of at home looking for jobs and whatnot here in Rhode Island, I was like, well, I got nothing else to do. You know, I can train. I can't go to Providence Barbell because it's closed, right? And all the other gyms are. So I can train in my garage, which saves me a bunch of time traveling. Mm-hmm. So why don't I really go at this thing and see where it goes. So at the time I was doing like two episodes a week, trying to put as much content out as possible, building out website, and you know, then it just kind of went from there. You know, I got a job working on the water, which was great. Well, a few jobs actually. And I just kept with it. I just kept going. And, you know, for me, it was telling the stories behind all the brands and the people, the things that I love to do, and the brands that I really love and respect, you know. You know, a few brands that I always thought were cool were, you know, Yeti and Costa, mm-hmm. right? Brands that people know, but they don't really know the story behind them, you know. You know, brands like Postfly, you know, and Badfish and all these other great brands that, you know, if you're on the water, you know what these brands are doing for the community. So how can we kind of tell that story and share that with someone that wants to buy a Badfish box or a Postfly or, you know, a Crafty One Customs rod or what have you. And then there's a lot of other brands out there that people don't know about, you know, that I come across, and they have a great story equally as good as, you know, the story of Yeti, you know, but it's just a smaller version. So that was kind of the beginning of what is now Along the Keel. And it's growing, you know, every day, which is cool.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, that's really cool. And so, you know, that's what you're doing is mostly seeking out the stories of the brands that you know, like, or kind of are impressed by, or don't know what mm-hmm. what the origin is? That's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah.
What's been your favorite one so far?
Like, man, it's hard to say, because when people ask that question, they're like, "What's your favorite one?" But everyone's story is different, you know. Like the folks from Rugged Seas that started this company where they take old bib material from fishing bibs and mm-hmm. commercial fishing, and they turn it into a backpack or a wallet or what have you. I mean, they were starting out like me, you know, at that time. And to see them grow into where they are now, it's been really cool to watch that growth. Yeah. You know, it's been really interesting to see that. So yeah, it's hard to say which one's my favorite, because well, there's so many cool stories.
That was probably a pretty lame question, but when I scroll through your Instagram and I see all the different ones, and there's a wide variety of companies that you've kind of told their story. So I guess a better question would be, like, is there a central theme that sticks out to you from mm-hmm. all of these people that are generally kind of creating something around something that they love, and they've somehow been successful with it? Is there a general mm-hmm. theme that you kind of, once you hear all these stories, you're kind of like, oh, there it is. Like, that's mm-hmm. what this other person said, and that's what this other person said, and that, what would that central theme be if you had one?
Yeah, you know, that's been the coolest part about this podcast, is getting to learn so much from all these businesses that, you know, started out in their garage, right? Like, there was a brand Jetty that started in a garage, and then they got ratted on by their neighbors. They had to move out, you know, and like, that story isn't told until you actually ask those questions. And I think a lot of the underlying themes are, you know, we see a niche that can be filled. We see a problem that can be solved. And, you know, they kind of take it upon themselves to say, hey, I think I can do it better. You know, I think I can help plant some mangroves and sell some t-shirts at the same time. And now it's called Man Gear Apparel, right? Or, you know, within the case of Jetty, they just wanted to help people. Like, they just wanted to help their community, and they wanted to put on surfing contests that, you know, helped friends with testicular cancer, and, you know, friends that just suffered a stroke, and all these other issues that no one was going to help them or do anything about it. So they took it in their own hands to do it, you know? So, and I think that's really what it's all about, is creating a community and a brand that lasts and that has some sort of impact, right? It's not just a product made in China that's shipped here and you have a cool website and then you focus on Facebook ads and Instagram ads. Like, that's not the brands that you're going to hear on Along the Keel. It's wholesome stories with people that really care about the ocean, the outdoors, and their community around them.
Awesome. So, well, yeah. If somebody wanted to check it out, how do they do it?
You can check it out on Spotify, Apple, pretty much anywhere you can find a podcast. And of course, Waypoint TV, the Waypoint Podcast Collective, which is awesome. Super stoked to be a part of that community. And you can also find us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram. Instagram is along_the_keel on Instagram. And on the bio, you can also find my Instagram profile as well. So yeah, pretty much anywhere and everywhere you can find us, alongthekeel.com. And we got some pretty cool things coming out in the spring. So
awesome.
Excited to kind of share that.
Well, Zach, man, I enjoyed getting to know you a little bit, and enjoyed talking lifting and training. I always like to talk about that. But, you know, anytime I can talk to somebody that's really into what they're doing, and they have a passion for it, that's the central theme that I get from my podcast when I talk to all these different people that I'm kind of drawn to, kind of mm-hmm. interesting stories, is the people that are the most interesting are kind of doing something because that's what they really want to do. And mm-hmm. and it seems like you're right there. That's what you want to do, and you're doing it.
Yeah, well, thanks. I'm trying.
All right. Well, I am going to be a guest on your podcast, so people can go check that out at some point, whenever that comes out. And I'm glad to have you on mine, man. We'll do it again.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, looking forward to it.
Okay.
Thanks, right. Tom.
See ya.
See ya.
You'd think, with four of us spread out on a tiny island, that the task of tagging a whitetail would not be a big thing. But, as I've learned, no matter where I've been, whitetails can be damn tricky. For
Pursuing wild game in wild places. Tune in to Hunt Stand Presents Saturdays at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.
Through the Blackwater bayous and in the dark Louisiana night, floats a duck camp, alive with the sounds of swamp pop and the smells of Cajun cooking. From the Mississippi Delta in Venice to the Cajun prairies of the Southwest, me and the Duck Camp Dinners crew will be hunting and eating it all.
This is Duck Camp Dinner.
Join me, Chef Jean-Paul Bourgeois, and the whole crew every Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.